Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll visit the community of Christmas, Florida, to talk with pioneer descendants.
Your community was your family. You know, you had to, if you grew citrus and your neighbor, had cattle, then you would trade and barter with them to get what your family needed to survive.
We'll discuss Christmases in Florida's past.
A look at the most beloved Florida literature and diaries and letters of earlier periods in Florida history show us a much different holiday season.
And with Hanukkah beginning this week, we'll talk about Jewish history in our state. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Oh, we need a little Christmas right this very minute. Candles in the window, carols at the spinet.
During the Second Seminole War of the 1830s, the United States Army built a series of forts around the state, about a day's walk apart. The idea was that soldiers could walk from one fort to another during the day and have someplace safe to sleep and store their provisions at night. Fort Christmas was constructed on December 25, 1837. The rural community of Christmas still exists in East Orange County off of State Road 50, about halfway between East Orlando and Titusville. Clarence Canada is president of the Fort Christmas Historical Society, and his family settled in the area before the Second Seminole War.
We are pioneer families back in the 1800s. Before they built the fort. this is a replica here. But however, during those times, I asked my dad how we got here, and he says they carved a path because there was no highways. They'd take a little bit every day, and they were fleeing up in Alabama, Georgia, because they were part of the Indian family. And so they migrated down to this area here and settled.
Because Clarence Canada's family included Native Americans, when the United States Army constructed Fort Christmas near their home, his ancestors were not happy about it. The Army was there to remove Native Americans from Florida.
Interesting enough, my great-grandfather, he was Irishman, had married Missouri, which was Chief Osceola's sister, and he fought with the Indians against the settlers that were coming in, the federal government, and so he took position with the Indians, and they rest in Montiac today, but the rest of the family had migrated down during that time. Of course, Osceola ended up in South Carolina at the fort.
Since significant portions of Canada's family were Caucasian, they were able to remain in the Christmas area after the war.
We settled, they had different settlements each family member carved out their own little life here and carved out their own little properties.
Lottie Kite works at Fort Christmas Historical Park. Her family established a homestead in the area shortly after the end of the Seminole Wars.
My grandfather was part of the Hodges family. They were one of the original pioneer families. They settled in the late 1890s, early 1900s. We actually still own the family homestead over off of Taylor Creek where they grew up and everything. It's been in the family for, I think, this is the sixth or seventh generation.
Like most early settlers, Kite's family participated in the agriculture industry.
They mostly were in citrus. My grandfather did do some work with the cattle as well. He worked for Mr. King when Mr. King owned Deseret Ranch before he sold it to them when he moved out to Texas and started the ranch out there.
In 1976, during America's bicentennial, interest developed in creating a replica of Fort Christmas near its original site. Over the years, pioneer homes and other structures, including a school, were relocated to Fort Christmas Historical Park. Clarence Canada remembers the site before the park was created.
When I was a child, that was back in the 50s, early 50s, the part was donated or sold. I don't remember. I believe part of the original part was the Chenoweths. They had an orange grove next door here, and all the part where the main office is now is that used to be orange grove and the tennis courts. And over behind us here where the Pioneer Village is, that used to belong to the Barber Farms Incorporated back in the 50s, 40s and 50s. And they had orange grove there as well.
The park originally was the picnic grounds for the community, and a lot of the families would come here and to celebrate all of their family milestones, birthdays, family reunions, things like that. And then they built the fort later on as a bicentennial project, and from there it's just grown, and it's a huge part of our community. We have community events, family reunions, birthday parties. A lot of the Pioneer families still come and celebrate things here and reminisce and everything.
Our family is in part of this out here as well, and we have some of our ancestors' memorabilia, along with Osceola, some of his stuff. And they actually found a dugout canoe in the river that's here now as well.
So here in Blockhouse 1, we have mostly our Seminole Indian War history. Downstairs is more based on the war itself, and up here we have a lot of the Seminole memorabilia and history and everything. The storehouse, of course, has like a tool display in it of stuff that they would have used back in that day to help build the structures and everything. Blockhouse 2 is going to hold all of our pioneer history, a lot of the cattle ranching and citrus industry stuff, and as well as all of our family genealogies and things like that.
Museum exhibits displayed inside the Fort Christmas replica and in the pioneer homes and buildings of the park commemorate the area's first settlers and their families. Christmas pioneer descendants Clarence Canada and Lottie Kite say that many pioneer descendants remain in the area.
As a child growing up, I got to visit with a lot of those folks because they were born in the 1800s, and they were, when I was born in the 50s, they were still in age and they lived a long time. And so I got to sit on the front porch while my dad took care of their properties. Well, we grew up in the cattle and citrus industry, and so they had the equipment and the knowledge. They helped these families, and I get to sit on the porch and talk with them.
There are quite a few of the original families still here in the community, the Clarks, the Yateses, our family, the Partons, the Tanners. A lot of those families still come back to the park and have their family reunions every year and everything, and it's really cool to see them come back and reminisce and everything.
We still have some remnants that are still here, the Parton family. There was, of course, as they married, the names changed along the way. And so those especially, the Tanner family were here as well. And several others, Reddits. It just goes on and on and on.
From what I've been told early on, you know, community was very important to the area. You had to rely on your neighbors for a lot of things because they didn't have, you know, the luxury of just running into town to get something or, you know, having a lot of that stuff on hand. So your community was your family. You know, you had to, if you grew citrus and your neighbor, you know, had cattle, then you would trade and barter with them to get what your family needed to survive.
We used to have a post office. The original was down the road here about a mile or so out east of us. And it was a general store as well, kind of like for dry goods. And they built the church, which I'm a member of, Pine Grove Baptist Church, in 1868. And the building that's there today is the third building, which is 1905. And that community, they gathered every Sunday, and they'd have a preacher come in, a circuit preacher, and once a month. And so they'd have big family gatherings and serve the Lord.
We spoke with descendants of pioneers in the Christmas community. Clarence Canada is president of the Fort Christmas Historical Society, and Lottie Kite works at Fort Christmas Historical Park. The park is located at 1300 Fort Christmas Road, which intersects State Road 50, about halfway between East Orlando and Titusville.
Need a little Christmas now.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. the holiday break is a great time to binge-watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, at myfloridahistory.org. Each episode looks at a different aspect of Florida history and culture. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, it's Christmas time. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Even though the town of Christmas is located in Florida, the state hardly fills the Courier and Ives vision of the December holiday. Media stories do nothing to help. Newscasts feature airport scenes showing the arrival of family and friends escaping the cold for a few days with Mickey and Minnie, complete with surfing Santas, twinkle-lit palm trees, and backyard Christmas dinners. Weather reporters delight in comparing Florida's balmy temperatures with the snowstorms elsewhere. For all of that, Florida manages to be more like the rest of the nation than different from it when it comes to celebrating the holiday. Christmas in Florida may be warmer, but the weeks and days leading up to Santa's visit are packed with shopping, cooking, event planning, and much more of the same. By the time the jolly old man makes it down the chimney or through the door, everyone is exhausted and overwrought.
Christmas time in Florida was much different in the past, though, right?
Yes, it was. A look at the most beloved Florida literature and diaries and letters of earlier periods in Florida history show us a much different holiday season. The most obvious difference is the lack of preparation. There were no frantic shopping trips to purchase just the right gift. Gifts were limited to members of the household. No colleagues or customers or even distant cousins were on the shopping list. Most gifts were handmade, not bought. Toys for children, including rag dolls, slingshots, and carved animals. Adults on the gift list receive knives, quilts, pipes, tobacco, and food, such as pies, cakes, preserves, or cookies. No one spent weeks decorating, no houses displaying lights visible from the space station, no blow-up Santas and snowmen. Christmas trees were cut and decorated on Christmas Eve or even Christmas Day. There were no blinking lights or expensive baubles. Trees were decorated with what was readily at hand. Ribbons, berries, pine cones, perhaps colored paper ornaments graced the tree. I once heard an oral history in which an elderly woman recalled that in her youth, the children saved the foil wrapping from the occasional chocolate Hershey bar to add to the Christmas tree as decoration. Likely no expensive ornament ever looked as beautiful as that glittering foil. Likewise, for busy farm families, Christmas dinner was not an elaborate affair, but made up of what was at hand. Men and boys hunted on Christmas Eve and even Christmas Day, and what they killed was what they ate. If they were lucky, everyone had turkey. The meat was supplemented with sweet potatoes, beans, cornbread, and pies. Those living close to the coast may also have enjoyed fish or shellfish.
Connie, Patrick Smith's The Land Remembered is probably the most beloved novel based on Florida history, and he describes a pioneer Christmas in that work.
Yes, in Chapter 22 of A Land Remembered, Patrick Smith writes a Christmas story that focuses on a community's Christmas dance, or frolic, an annual event for young people. The chapter begins 3 days before Christmas, with Zeck on his way to Fort Drum. Christmas, in Zeck's experience, was, quote, a festive time he had never really known, although his mother, quote, always tried to fix something special for Christmas dinner, baking sweet potato pies covered with wild honey, a turkey if his father could kill one, or whatever else was available to mark this one day from all the others. There had been no gaily decorated tree, no exchange of colorfully wrapped gifts, no frolic or church services, in his experience. Smith describes the scene. Cold December wind stung his face as Zek rode alone across the prairie. There had been no change of seasons here, no brilliant colors to signal the coming of fall, no bare trees surrounded by decaying leaves to herald winter, no ice-covered bushes or frozen ponds. Zek has money in his pocket to purchase Christmas gifts for his parents, a knife for his father, and lilac water for his mother. He reaches the trading post just at dark and persuades Mr. Turner to keep the store open long enough for him to buy his gifts. Once he has completed his purchases, he heads over to the frolic at the meeting hall with some trepidation. It is his first frolic, and he doesn't know what to expect. Still, he is excited about the frolic, and as he enters the meeting hall, he sees Glinda, red hair standing out like a flag, wearing a blue dress decorated with white lace and a blue ribbon in her hair. Although he had anticipated the moment, he is embarrassed for his own appearance, his faded jeans, dusty boots, and denim jacket. Had he known about Christmas frolics, he would have purchased suitable clothing, but no one told him. Zek tries dancing, but quickly decides dancing isn't his strong suit and thinks he better stick to horses. Glinda sees a different man and tries to persuade him that she is interested. When he finally leaves the dance, he is excited but conflicted. Later, he recounts the event and his feelings to Emma, his mother. Although Zek sees himself as awkward and out of place at the dance, his mother sees what Glinda saw. She explains what was essential to life on the Florida prairie. Girls want a man, not a fancy dancer, who couldn't skin a rabbit if his family was starving. You've got strength like your father. Glinda has more sense than you give her credit for. She knows what she is doing, and it turns out she did.
Connie, T. Thomas Fortune's work is included in an anthology of African-American Christmas stories, and he's from Florida.
Yes, T. Thomas Fortune, a Black 19th century Florida author and editor of the New Age newspaper, also used Christmas Eve to tell a story of conflict and romance. Titled Marmora's Christmas Test, it is set in the fictional town of Jason in the land of sunshine and flowers, of mockingbirds and alligators. Fortune creates a scene between Marama Young, a Black schoolteacher, and her future husband, Alexander Simpson, the principal of the school where she teaches. The two are quarreling, as they apparently do rather frequently, and always about the same thing. Simpson, who learned carpentry from his father before attending college, wants to leave education and become a lawyer. Ms. Young wants him to return to carpentry and go into partnership with her father, who operates a successful construction business. She believes that the more practical option offers the greater chance for success. Simpson views the prestige of law as the better choice, deeming manual labor beneath the dignity of his college degree. The disagreement that Fortune creates in this story is one that also roiled the Black community in the period. Practical education and pursuits versus higher education and professional life. Marama seems to have the upper hand in the argument when she declares that she will call off the engagement if Simpson continues in his plans to pursue a career in law. Suddenly, Simpson sees a way to obtain what he really wants, marriage to the charming Marama. "If I do what you want, will you fix the date for the wedding?" he asks. "Certainly," she says, "I will fix the day any time you say after you write your resignation to the school board. That is your Christmas test." Alexander took the fountain pen and, securing a sheet of paper, wrote his resignation to the school board to take effect at the end of the holidays and handed it to Marama. She reads through it carefully and said, "We'll fix the date of the wedding. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock," said Alexander. "Oh, that is the Christmas test," exclaimed Marama. "Yes, it's Marama's Christmas test," said Alexander Simpson.
Thanks, Connie.
Welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, throw cares away, Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold. Ding dong, ding dong, that is their song, with joyful ring, all caroling, one seems to hear words of cheer.
This is Florida Frontiers. As Hanukkah begins this week, it's a good time to reflect on the rich Jewish history in Florida. Conversos, Jews who publicly converted to Christianity under the threat of the Spanish Inquisition, probably came to Florida in the 1500s and continued practicing their religion secretly. Spanish records list people with Sephardic Jewish names among the first settlers of St. Augustine. Jewish people could not legally live in Florida until 1763, which is when Alexander Solomons, Joseph de Palacios, and Samuel Israel immigrated to Pensacola. This fascinating history and much more is preserved at the Jewish Museum of Florida in Miami Beach. Long before the museum came into existence, founding executive director Marcia Jo Zervetz began a quest to collect and document Jewish history throughout Florida.
I moved to Florida in 1960, had always been involved in the organized Jewish community, and was rather horrified that there was no documentation of Jewish history in Florida. I couldn't understand that. I was involved nationally, and everywhere I traveled, I would meet with other women, and we talked about why we were involved, and they were involved because their mothers or their grandmothers or their aunts, somebody in the family had been involved, and I'm thinking, the Jews in Florida are really bereft of a history. There has to be something. We talk about Jewish continuity. How can you have continuity if you don't have a past? So I started asking a lot of questions because I tend to do that. And to my horror, no one had ever researched or documented it at all. The scholars up east considered Florida not important for Florida Jewish history. They assumed it began on Miami Beach after World War II, and that was the beginning and the end. So I said, no, there's got to be more to it. So I actually started a fabulous personal adventure that I think has benefited the entire state, not just the Jewish community, but the totally multi-ethnic community that we have, because the story that we are telling is of the immigrant experience. And I think some people tend to forget that all of us are of immigrant stock, of some generation. Someone came from another place to America and to Florida. So I started an 8-year adventure. I traveled around the state, starting with Pensacola to Key West, and a lot of people don't realize that's 1,000 miles. We're a very long state. And I met with people in each community, volunteers, lay people, and I said, we need to research and document the history, the Jewish history of your community. And people would constantly say, oh, there's no history here. And I said, well, whatever it is, we want to retrieve it.
Zervetz organized teams of volunteers in 13 Jewish communities around the state, including Pensacola, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, Miami, and Key West. She learned how to conduct interviews from oral historian Samuel Proctor at the University of Florida. For 8 years, Zervetz and her team of volunteers collected stories, photographs, and artifacts. Zervetz then assembled a team of professionals to help her create a touring exhibition called Mosaic, Jewish Life in Florida. After opening at the Historical Museum of Southern Florida in Miami in October 1990, the Mosaic exhibit traveled to venues including the Flagler Museum in St. Augustine, the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee, and the T.T. Wentworth Museum in Pensacola, introducing audiences to Florida's Jewish history.
We did not even know at the time that Jews could not live in Florida for 250 years after Florida was discovered. Only Catholics could live here from the time Ponce de Leon discovered Florida in 1513 until after the French-Indian War, when the Treaty of Paris was signed in Paris, France, in December of 1762. That was when Florida was traded from the Spanish to the British, and the British, desperate for settlement, allowed anyone to settle, including Jews. So it so happens that that same treaty gave Louisiana, took it away from the French and gave it to the Spanish. So Jews who were living in New Orleans, for example, had to leave because Jews could not live anywhere in the world under Spanish rule. And three of them went to Pensacola, Florida in 1763. So that was the beginning of documented Jewish life in Florida. We also found out that Florida was brought into statehood in 1845, the 27th state, by David Levi Yulee, a Jew, the first person of Jewish ancestry to even serve in the United States Congress. But who knew? So we have had more than 250 Jewish mayors. In other words, we have contributed, we as a Jewish community, have contributed greatly to every area of development of Florida, but nobody knew the stories. So this exhibit became very popular, and people along the way would say, you know, you've been wandering Jews long enough. People knew, even non-Jewish people know the term wandering Jews. So they said, you need to find a permanent home. Obviously, everything that you've collected, and I had collected about 6,000 photos and documents and artifacts, wasn't everything. So they said, you need a home.
In the mid-1990s, the Jewish Museum of Florida found a home in what had been Miami Beach's first synagogue in 1929 and an Orthodox synagogue next door built in 1936. Marcia Jozarevitz led the restoration of the buildings in 1993.
We're sitting now in a 1936 Art Deco design by Henry Hohauser, the most prominent of the Art Deco architects, designed this building in 1936 as the second synagogue for the first Jewish congregation on Miami Beach that started in 1929 in the building which we now own next door. But we started in this primary building, the 80 stained glass windows, a Moorish copper dome, a sloping floor. Had a lot of challenges because how do you create a museum with a sloping floor and stained glass windows all over? But we were able to do it, and we raised the money. The building was about to be torn down, I should mention. The buildings are both on the National Register of Historic Places, but our city was letting them be torn down. So I went to the city immediately to get a moratorium against tearing them down. I said, give me 6 months to see if I can raise the money. So we did raise the money, and we restored this building. And we opened in 1995, and were extremely successful in telling the story of the immigrant experience, being focused on the Jewish story, but the acculturation process of everyone's family.
The exhibition Mosaic, Jewish Life in Florida, makes up the core of the Jewish Museum of Florida. A timeline at the front of the museum places Florida's Jewish history in a national and international context. Documents, photographs, and artifacts are displayed, including the watch belonging to George Dolinsky of Jacksonville,
who is the first known Jewish boy born in Florida in 1857. Now, there are several reasons why I like that watch. First of all, on the back, it has a relief of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. It's a beautiful artifact. And the numerals, the hours are in Hebrew Yiddish letters. But the significance of the fact that the first known Jewish boy born in Florida was so proud of his Jewish heritage that he carried this watch his whole life, and that it speaks loudly to the fact that, yes, Jews were here that early. He wasn't the first child that we know of born in Florida. There was a Jewish girl born in Pensacola. Yeah, Virginia Myers in 1822, but we don't have anything of her. We have a picture of George, and we have this artifact.
In addition to collecting Jewish history in Florida, creating the Mosaic exhibition, and establishing the Jewish Museum of Florida, Marcia Jozarevitz is author of the book Jews of Florida, Centuries of Stories, published in 2020 by the History Press. She also co-wrote The Florida Jewish Heritage Trail, published by the Florida Department of State, which identifies 250 sites of historic significance. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and listen as a podcast. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester this week, and the program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays from all of us here at the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.